Hi there, listeners. Welcome to episode 244 of Never on the Back Foot podcast. India won 10 straight matches to reach the final on home soil, but were beaten on the day by an Aussie side who delivered in all facets of the game to run out winners by 6 wickets. This is Australia's 6th ODI World Cup in men's cricket, and their invincibility just seems to get better with each passing day. In this episode, we discuss the match at large, Australia's dominance, India's downfall, yet commendable and unbelievable campaign, and a lot more. Ladies and gentlemen, have you ever felt sad over and over again for a decade and a half and wondered whom to blame after losing another knockout game? Well, for no reason whatsoever, feel free to blame this random dude that's returning to our podcast after some atrocious pre-World Cup predictions. On that note, welcome back, Sachit. And without further ado, let's get started. Hi, Sachit. Welcome back to Never on the Back Foot podcast. You know, it's again a sad occasion that we reunite to discuss India's performance yesterday at the final. So, how are you feeling back on?
Well, first things first, it's good to be back.
Mm-hmm.
I know it's a sad occasion. I know the last time I was here, it was after a terrible West Indies series.
Mm.
But yeah, it feels good to be back. It feels nice that quite a few things that I predicted during that podcast episode actually came true. So yeah, I'll take that as a win at least.
One positive. And just looking at this match now, what were your predictions heading into it? Because everyone had, I think, given India a clean sheet, like, hey, they're definitely winning this. And Australia was, you know, the second favorite team entering this contest. So did you expect what happened yesterday as the reality?
See, I'll be very honest with you. Before the World Cup started itself, we do this thing on our WhatsApp group chat where all of us throw in some predictions before the World Cup.
Mm-hmm.
And the two things that I predicted at that point was, one, India play Australia in the finals, which ended up happening.
Mm.
And two, I said Australia would win the World Cup because we have a track record of choking in knockout games, okay?
Mm-hmm.
But I swear to God, the way we played this World Cup, the way we actually managed to win 10 out of 10 and make it to the finals, I was begging to every heavenly celestial entity that my predictions would go wrong because I really wanted India to win the cup, and they deserved it. I'm gutted right now. Okay, it was so. I don't have the words.
Certainly, and I hope, you know, through this episode we can put it in perspective for us and also for all the listeners, because writing pointers for this episode was painful enough. Now I hope, you know, recording it certainly helps give some amount of closure, because now the way India lost the match yesterday, right, was really hard to watch and digest. So what were your first thoughts on the loss that we endured yesterday? And it just seems like a nightmare that you want to be woken up from.
Look, let me just give you a small picture of my experience yesterday, okay?
Mm-hmm.
I live in JP Nagar. My friend lives in Marthali, which are 18 kilometers apart. And this guy says, come over to my house. We watch the match. I'm like, sure, I'm willing to ride 18 kilometers to watch a World Cup final. I put on my earphones and blast music all the way from my house to his house. And I'm vibing the whole time. I go there and then the game happens, and then I'm just so disappointed at everything that's going on.
Yeah.
And I, after one point, after the Travis Head inning started, we kind of realized that it's over.
Mm.
But, you know, just for the sake of it, I thought, okay, one last prediction time. Travis Head will get out eventually and Maxwell will hit the winning runs is what I said, which ended up happening. So, hey, we ended on a fun note, I guess. But so, like, when the game ended, the gravity of the situation hadn't hit me yet. Everything was a little blank in my head. So I got back onto my scooter and I started riding 18 kilometers back. And I, after getting home, I realized that 18 kilometers, there was no music. There was only silence. The only voice in my head was Google Maps. And once I reached home, I looked at the time and I realized that I traveled 18 kilometers in less than 25, 30 minutes. And I realized how fast I was going, and I actually endangered my own life because nothing in my brain was working at that point. And then slowly, once I got home, I started looking at everything online. I started reading the messages on the group chats, and then it started hitting me. And yeah, slowly I started it just hit me like a truck, and then slowly I started falling down that little void, which we've fallen down multiple times over the past decade. And like every other Indian in the country, cried myself to sleep. Woke up this morning, saw more videos. Everyone's going emo on the internet. I want to leave Insta, but at the same time, I want to sit there and abuse a few Pakistani fans who are taking much more joy in this than the Australians are. So yeah, that's how the feeling is right now.
Certainly. I mean, even as RCB fans, this one hurts a lot more, right? Because the Indian team was almost like
Look,
the
we've had
Avengers.
training for 16 years, dude. We've had training for 16 years, and we still end up collapsing down this little void of sorrow.
Exactly. And looking at India also, coming into this match with a 10 match winning streak, it came to this abrupt end, and it's a debilitating loss when you look at it, because you're playing against Australia as well. So how would you assess the loss? And I think even through the episode we will be discussing like aspects that didn't work out and stuff, but like initial assessments of the loss.
I think before we look at the loss by itself, we need to look at how Australia got there, right? Because India dominated throughout their first 10 games. League stage, they've beaten Australia in the league stage. And then they go ahead and win all their 9 games in league stage, convincingly destroy New Zealand with Shami taking 7. And like they are looking all set for the finals. And then Australia, on the other hand, they lose 2 games. And then they win 8 in a row. And the reason, like, look, they've lost 2 games, and then their qualification was actually a little on the fence. It kind of started with their win against New Zealand. But I think the actual domino effect that's happened is a random DRS call for Maxwell, which has gone over the wicket. Mujib dropping Maxwell's catch, Maxwell scoring 200, Australia suddenly looking like a different team altogether, and suddenly they go into their semi-finals. Their semi-final is against South Africa, a team that beat them during the league stage. South Africa actually end up winning the toss, and in Eden Gardens, if you've won the toss and you've batted first, it's almost as if you've won the game, except on that specific day, there's overcast conditions, there's rain on the cards, which is why Australia managed to take 4 wickets early on. So they have South Africa at 44 for 4, which actually helped them win a game that they would have otherwise lost if South Africa actually batted without any overcast conditions, because that's how an Eden Gardens pitch is. You bat second, you're almost out of the game. And then they show up at the World Cup finals. And Australia in ICC tournament finals is just different gravy from day one, like from the history of the sport beginning until this day. It is impossible to imagine Australia losing in a final. Yes, it's happened a couple of times, but it is so rare that, like, forget about the men, even the women, they barely ever lose. So like Australia and World Cup finals is just different gravy. But for the first time ever, they're coming in as underdogs. So India actually has a chance out of nowhere. And Pat Cummins goes ahead and says, we're gonna have a bowl first, because everyone else in the country, including the experts, they think, yeah, any team that wins the toss has to bat first here. Cummins out of nowhere says we're going to bowl first, and everyone is confused. Everyone's happy. Why? Because Rohit Sharma says, yeah, we wanted to bat first anyway. And everything just went downhill, dude.
Pretty much, yeah. Actually, my next point was going to be that because quite the shocker, right? Australia won the toss, they decide to bowl first. But do you think that is like a big setback for Team India? I mean, as you rightly pointed out, Rohit Sharma also mentioned that, you know, batting first is also something that India wanted to do. But then do you think somewhere they gained that psychological edge by doing something totally out of the box?
Yeah, look, I think it's a very classic Australian thing to do. I mean, if we look back at that 2003 finals, you remember Ponting and his men just showing up to an Indian team's training session and doing absolutely nothing but sit there in silence and watching them practice. And that somehow just gets into the heads of the Indians, right? What does Cummins do this time? He doesn't do something which is directly as intimidating. But the confidence that was exerted from the Australians, right? Cummins shows up at the press conference on the previous day and he says, there's nothing more satisfying than watching a crowd of 1,30,000 people just silenced. And
Yeah.
that's our goal for tomorrow. And people are just like, hang on, wait, what's going on here? And then he shows up at the task the next day. And when everyone is expecting him to say, we're going to bat first, he says, we're going to have a bowl first. And that's starting to create certain doubts inside the heads of the Indians. They're like, wait, hold on, why is this guy opting to bowl first? Is this actually going to be a helpful pitch for bowling? What's going on here? So like the mental battle by itself, in my opinion, was won at the toss.
Certainly, and a lot of like experts and fans were bamboozled by that decision that eventually worked out well for Australia, I suppose. But now India, right, looking to bat first. Did you think they were thinking of going in for a competitive total? Because hey, it's, you're playing against the likes of Australia, so having that big total would certainly be helpful.
Yes, a big total would have been helpful. Honestly, in my opinion, look, the average score on an Ahmedabad pitch is, I'd say, 280 to 290. But given that there was quite a bit of dew yesterday, I think we wouldn't have had any chance unless we had a score of maybe 320 or above that. So, given that we scored 240, we were already 40 under par. So forget about a winning total. We didn't even cross the par score of 280.
Exactly. And on the same line of thought, how would you assess the Narendra Modi Stadium pitch? Because the conditions were also like debated upon, discussed upon so much. There's a lot of chatter from the Aussie campaign that, you know, the pitch is not suitable and reports of some chemicals being used to get that dew factor in check. So do you think there's just a lot of unnecessary discourse around this pitch and the outfield and everything?
Look, I'm going to quote Ravi Shastri here. Pitch jo bhi ho, 10 wicket nikalne hai. Because
Yeah.
screw the pitch. Pitch bhaad mein jaye is what Ravi Shastri had said. It's honestly, it's a 50-50 thing, right? You win a toss, you lose a toss. It doesn't matter. Irrespective of what the pitch is, you have to go there and put on your best show. And I think the Australians feeling a little bit, I think the pitch did freak them out initially. And there was an interview with Ricky Ponting later after the game, and in which he said he'd had a chat with the team just before the game, and they were worried about the pitch. But then again, I think there was a little bit of a Ponting pep talk influence in the way that they ended up playing. But in my opinion, the curator does prepare the pitch to help the Indian team more, right? Because it is a home game. We do expect to have a home advantage. That's what we've had throughout the World Cup. And it's true that the curator prepares the pitch to give us conditions that would probably help us more. So from that perspective, he did prepare a pitch that was difficult to bat on. So the idea there was for the Australian team to go out there and find it quite a tough task to score any runs on it. But the call that he made kind of ended up backfiring on us because we ended up batting first. And the fact that dew came in later actually made it easier for the Australians to bat. Because the thing is, in the Narendra Modi Stadium, due usually kicks in by around 8 p.m. And this is something that, again, I was telling everyone that I was watching the game with. Once we scored 240, I said, if Maxwell is not out before the 20th over, there is no way we're winning the game. Because you cannot pick up wickets properly after 8, 8:15 p.m. because the dew gets so heavy, it is extremely difficult to bowl after that point. So your only window to pick up as many wickets as possible is in between the overs 1 to 20, 25 max, okay? So that's the situation that we were faced with. We had a perfect start. We got early wickets, but I'll be honest with you, with the kind of dew that shows up in that stadium, if we didn't have 5 within the first 25 overs, we had no chance afterwards.
Certainly. And to give, you know, due credit to Team India, had a great start, you know, as Rohit Sharma set the platform. And although I think Shubman Gill was out early, do you think his dismissal was like a big setback in the context of this match?
Look, it felt perfectly set up for a Shubman Gill classic, okay? Like, it's his favorite ground, and then there's a certain someone present in the stands watching the game. Sachin Tendulkar is also there. But like, his dismissal in the context of the game was probably not one of the primary reasons for the problems that came later on, because he got out and then Rohit and Virat just stabilized the innings after that. It wasn't too much of an issue given the point at which his dismissal happened. Like, he had an early dismissal, which is okay. But Virat and Rohit came in later and they stitched a good partnership. And I think things started spiraling downhill only after 2 more wickets fell from here. So honestly, in my opinion, Gill's dismissal, not a big setback.
Fair enough.
Also, I want to point out one thing. A very scary parallel between this World Cup and the 2003 World Cup. Sachin Tendulkar also ended up scoring 4 runs in the 2003 World Cup. You see the connection right there, do you?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of parallels that you also said you would bring up through the course of our discussion. But hey, let's, you know, again, focus on this match now. Again, when we look at Rohit Sharma and the kind of starts he's given Team India through the World Cup, it's been quite commendable. But we've seen how that one irresponsible shot he plays, he gets back to the pavilion. So how would you look at like his role and performances through this World Cup and even his captaincy at large?
Look, I'm going to tell you, as a captain, Rohit Sharma has been absolutely brilliant. Okay, I found very few flaws, and those flaws also just ended up showing up only in the finals. Like, until the finals, none of those flaws were exposed, and we'll get to that later. But as an opening batter, there is nothing better you could do as an opening batter than to set the tone for your team. And it is something that we've seen Virender Sehwag do time and time again. And Rohit Sharma took that role upon himself. He played very selflessly. He played innings which actually mattered. Those quick 40s, 50s that he was scoring were extremely impactful for the team. And the template that he managed to set for the Indian team is, I score quick runs, Virat Kohli stabilizes it later. If I fail, I know that there is a Virat Kohli behind me to like hold the innings together for a decent amount of time and rebuild it, which actually ended up happening in the finals as well. But it's just that Kohli couldn't convert. We'll get to that again. But I think the template was set, and if Gill can contribute to that template, it's great. But I think when you speak about the responsibility fact, he did have a few irresponsible shots throughout the World Cup, which were not that highly talked about, because we've won all those games, right? They were all high-scoring games. We ended up batting well even after Rohit's wicket. But in this case, only because it's a final, after he's gotten 2 boundaries off Maxwell's bowling, I did not think it was necessary to step out like that and blindly swing at that ball and top edge it to Travis Head, which was a brilliant catch, by the way. Travis Head took a really good catch. But yeah, I mean, it's just one of those days where it just didn't work out for him.
Definitely. And I think we gave, due credit to Rohit Sharma. Like, I think his batting reminded us a lot of his 2019 World Cup form, where, he was scoring those runs at will. And finally, he looked like the man, who was that responsible top order batter. And, talking about Virat Kohli, now he was the next man in. And I think through this World Cup, the team management has made it very clear that his role is that of an anchor, someone who's going to hold the innings together. So, in the context of this match, how would you look at his performance? Because we saw, right, how the middle overs is getting really tricky to get those runs, and we could see him just stagnate. For the lack of a better word, I'm going to use stagnant. So how do you look at it?
Look, if you take a look at Virat's strike rate overall, it was 85, which is, in my opinion, a really good strike rate on this pitch. The way the pitch was behaving at that point of time, I think the way Virat was batting was actually perfect. The lack of boundaries at that point, in my opinion, was not Virat's fault because he was still rotating strike. The dot balls were piling up on the other end. And there's not much you can do about it. But having said that, that inside edge to Cummins led to his downfall. It was, it's, I won't call it a bad shot. It's not even poor shot selection. It is just bad execution of that shot. He wanted to run it down to third man, but he ended up getting an inside edge on it. And I think that was the moment Cummins knew. Like he also mentioned in a post-match interview that the second Virat's wicket fell, the whole stadium went quiet and the entire team gathered together in a huddle to embrace that silence. And moments like this actually give teams like Australia really, really high levels of confidence. So from that moment onwards, Australia had the upper hand. None of the batters could actually get going. And yeah, the batting after this was not going to take them to a target of 280 because I'll get to this part in a little more detail a little later. But Surya and Jadeja were not up to the mark with their batting.
Exactly.
Even though KL's strike rate will be talked about a lot, I still think Surya and Jadeja's contributions yesterday were very under par.
Definitely. And before we get to the duo of Jaddu and Sky, now you had Shreyas Iyer, right, who's had a golden World Cup. So when even though we lost Virat Kohli, like in the manner we did, we thought, hey, you'd have someone like a Shreyas Iyer who could score those crucial runs and be there when the team needed him the most. But again, his dismissal kind of was far from ideal at that point in the game. So again, your thoughts on his dismissal, and do you think that was like a game-changing moment or so?
It was because I think that's what ended up putting Kohli and KL under pressure, right? So the comparison here that I'd like to bring in, yes, Shreyas got out and he got out cheap, but let's not forget that we're in this final because of his knock against New Zealand. Okay, so look, I don't like to see social media buzzing with all this blame on him, on any of the players, to be honest. But yes, he got out cheap. It was the wrong game to get out that cheap. But that ended up putting pressure on Kohli and KL to bat long and bat deep, which is probably one of the reasons for the dot balls that happened here. And the picture I want to paint here is a small comparison between this game and the first game of our tournament, where again, we took on Australia and there were early wickets. So the difference between these two games is in the first game, we were chasing and there was only 199 on the scoreboard. So there were enough balls to chase it. We knew exactly how many balls we had to chase it and there were minimal risks to take. In this case, we're batting first, we're on a Narendra Modi Stadium pitch, which everyone knows is going to ease out a little later if dew comes in. So the par score would be at least 100 runs more than what they chased in the first game. So they are expected to play it a little slow and hopefully accelerate later. But the fact that nobody really knows what the par score is going to be because of the dew coming in later, made them a little jittery. And that kind of ended up putting pressure on both these guys, which ended up causing the dot balls. There was only one boundary in that period. Then Virat got out, and then that whole thing spiraled down again.
That's true, because with KL also joining Virat in the middle, there were phases, right, where we saw no boundaries at all, which I think complicated the matter a lot. Even the viewers were getting like bored, it was just getting like stagnant, the crowds were just like not making any noise. So again, would you give credit to the Aussie bowling there? And do you think the pitch was actually getting that, complicated and challenging that, scoring runs was difficult, or were they just like engaging in self-preservation there?
No, I think it wasn't difficult to score runs. Okay, it wasn't as difficult as it looked like, but I think the idea at that point was to rotate strike and just play out the next 10, 20 overs, because the template that we've been following throughout the World Cup is the top order gives you a decent start, and then number 3, 4, and 5 take on the maximum part of the overs, which is maybe overs 11 to 35, 36. And then Jadeja Sky come and finish it off. But given that we've had very quick wickets fall in like a very short duration of time, even though our run rate was pretty well placed, I think the reason our run rate was pretty well placed is why Kohli and KL decided to take it a little bit easier, because you have a decent run rate going. You are 116 overs, which is a really good position to be in at that point, even though you've lost 3 wickets. So you can just tonk it around, play a few singles, rotate strike, and take the game a little deep. But the issue over there was the fact that Kohli was rotating strike, but KL was not able to take the ball into the gaps, which again is a large factor which was caused by the Australian fielding. But KL being unable to rotate strike from his end ended up accumulating a lot of dot balls on that side. So yeah, credit to the Australian bowling. Their field placement was immaculate, and I don't know, man, it was beautifully strategized. It looked like they'd done their homework. So yeah.
Certainly. And even with Kohli not being able to convert his knock into a big one, KL Rahul also taking a lot of time to settle in, the dots were piling. Now even their dismissals and Sky and Jaddu not being able to do their role to proper justice, do you think all of these reasons kind of ensure that India was not able to put up that big total and fold it for 240?
Yeah, absolutely. Look, the reason KL ended up playing an innings like he did was because they were already 4 down. He knows that the only 2 batters left are Sky and Jadeja. And you take a closer look at their batting, Jadeja is usually a hit or miss type of a batter. Sometimes you get really good knocks from him, but off late his batting has dipped a little bit. And with Sky, you just never know, right? Because it's an ODI format. He's not exactly been that great throughout the World Cup, even though I don't blame him, because that's been his role. Come in, swing, hope that he can get some runs out of there. But the fact that Jadeja got out pretty quick, and then Sky came in and wasn't able to take anything to the boundary, and it was putting even more pressure on KL Rahul at that point of time. And I think one major flaw in the way that Suryakumar Yadav was batting was the fact that he kept trying to access the boundary behind square, which is, yes, it's something that he's done a lot throughout his career. But on a slow pitch like this, getting the ball away behind square, especially when you have the Australian bowlers bowling cutters, like Pat Cummins was bowling really good slower balls throughout the game, and you can't exactly access the boundary behind square in situations like that, because there's no pace to take the ball away. So the ideal situation here would be to keep knocking it around, take singles, and maybe try to access the boundary in front of square, because their field setting was actually very well planned out for Sky as well, because they had a short fine leg. They weren't allowing Sky to go over that short fine leg because they weren't giving him pace to do it. And each time he tried to access that short fine leg, he wasn't able to get it past that man, or he just ended up missing the ball and it just went into the keeper's hands. So they managed to put in enough pressure on both these batters, and eventually they succumbed to it.
Yeah, and a lot of criticism was directed at Sky and Jaddu, for not being able to get their shots right and, get those crucial runs on the board as well. Now, I think somewhere, Rohit Sharma also mentioned that India's easily 20, 30 runs short. But as fans and I think experts, we certainly felt it was a lot more. What do you think? Do you think those 20, 30 runs would have made a difference, or we should have certainly aimed for like a 270, 280?
Yeah, look, 280, as I said, we were 40 short if there was no due. But because there was due in the game later on, we were at least 60 short. And this is something that I'd mentioned even in the previous episode that I was in. Like, after the West Indies series, look, we didn't have a fairly large idea of what the team was going to look like. But I'd given you a brief layout of what the team was going to look like. And one very specific thing that I'd mentioned was, you have your top six sorted. You know that your number seven is Jadeja. It'll all come down to how you manage your 8, 9, 10, and 11. And I said that it was going to be Kuldeep, Siraj, and Bumrah. Now, Shami coming in was definitely a boost for us from a bowling perspective. But the fact that, I mean, the reason why in that episode, I mentioned that it was going to have to be either Shardul Thakur or Akshar Patel at number 8. Yes, Akshar Patel got injured, so they ended up playing Ashwin in one of the games. But the reason I would have wanted to see a little bit of batting capability at number 8 was specifically for a situation like this in a final where there is extra pressure. You have people collapsing in the top order. I mean, not necessarily the top order, but like, you have wickets falling in a cluster, right? So in situations like this, it would really help to have a little more batting capability at maybe number 8, just so that those 20, 30 runs that Rohit Sharma mentioned could have been achieved in some of the other manner. And if I'm not wrong, the team that I predicted for the World Cup in the previous episode was exactly the team that ended up playing, apart from Shardul Thakur, who started off in the main 11, and then Hardik's injury ended up, which is another issue. Like, Hardik, if he didn't get injured, I think would have strengthened the batting way more.
Definitely, we were missing him out, and he was kind of that what do you say, X factor or the balance that India needed, across the bowling and the batting department. But, I think a large credit again goes to the Aussie bowling, right? Because they work so well in restricting this Indian batting that had the reputation through the World Cup of getting those big totals on board. So how would you look at the Aussie bowling and stuff that worked well for them?
Look, first things first, I want to say that Mitchell Starc, in every damn final or knockout game that he plays, he's just made of clutch genetic materials. I don't know how he does this every single time. He's not really had the best of World Cups so far. But commit the final, commit the man, I guess. So he ended up bowling extremely well. Cummins, Hazelwood were also top class. But more than the actual bowling, I think the field setting and the actual fielding by itself was unreal. Okay, like, Pat Cummins' field setting for Rohit Sharma in the first 6, 7 overs. I don't know. Like, look, even though Rohit finished at a higher strike rate, it was largely because of that last 6 and 4 that he hit off Glenn Maxwell. Okay, so that happened in two balls. Before that, his strike rate wasn't looking all that great. Yes, he'd gotten a few boundaries, but they'd actually done a really good job at restricting Rohit Sharma's boundaries. How they had this weird forward point present on one boundary line, and they had another square leg on the other boundary line. So the two shots that we've seen Rohit Sharma play the most in the power play this World Cup is the pull shot and this shot where he just steps out and hits it over cover or over point. And those two shots were completely blocked off by the Australian fielders. And if you notice, there was actually a half chance that was generated when Rohit tried to play a pull shot as well. Like there was a catch that just fell short of the square leg fielder. And there were a couple of shots that he tried to hit over cover or over point, and that forward point fielder managed to come in and hit, like block it off. And I swear to God, the amount of times we were abusing the Australian fielders because Warner was everywhere. Like wherever the ball went, Warner was there. It was unbelievable. For a man that is 37 years old, he showcased an insanely high amount of fitness to put in those dives to field the ball. I think the 20-30 runs that Rohit Sharma mentioned in the post-match interview, they were blocked off by the Australians here through their fielding itself. And look, Warner was one name. I think Labuschagne and Smith were brilliant as well and head with that catch. And I think Josh Inglis as a wicketkeeper yesterday was absolutely brilliant because the number of balls that went down the leg side by the fast bowlers that he managed to cut off from going to the boundary, like it could have easily been five wides, but he kept it down to just a wide and not an extra four runs. So top class.
Definitely. That's actually a fair point to bring in of, you know, how besides the bowling, even their fielding was just top-notch and unbelievable. Now, even now, when you try to look at the run chase for the Aussies, they were, you know, looking to wrap up the match in no time because we saw how Warner had that blitzkrieg knock of 7, but it came to an end because, you know, Siraj struck. So at that point also, did you think that it was advantage India and we could still somehow apply pressure because of the way India's bowling had been through the tournament?
Look, I was actually very surprised to see Mohammad Shami bowling the second over. But the fact that he managed to get a wicket off his first ball was excellent. And I know it's always easier to have Siraj bowling earlier because he extracts a little more swing and all. But yes, Shami bowling that second over actually came out as a better scenario for us because he ended up picking up Warner's wicket. But at this point, I was already wondering how, the bowling is going to go. Because one thing that we noticed even in the first innings was India had already started panicking. The fact that Jadeja came out to bat before Suryakumar Yadav was already proof that we were having those jitters. So maybe Australia would have found a little bit of satisfaction in the fact that Rohit Sharma had to change plans to pick up these wickets because he didn't go out with his same, with his usual template of bowling Bumrah and Siraj in the first spell. He ended up taking Siraj out of the equation and bowling Shami. So at this point, I was already, worried about the mindset that the Indian team was in. But the fact that Shami took that wicket actually sparked a huge amount of confidence in me that maybe we have a chance now.
Exactly. And now, you know, again, Mitch Marsh was another, you know, who struck a few. And there's this whole chatter before the match about him mentioning in some Delhi Capitals podcast that, you know, that Australia had grand plans of defeating India in this final and all. So again, with Mitch Marsh coming at the crease, the everyone's like, yeah, we have to get him out fast and India's going to win this match. And again, his dismissal must have sparked some hope and given, you know, that much needed enthusiasm to the crowd. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, look, I think Mitch Marsh's prediction was Australia 450 for two in the first innings and India 65 all out. But the first boundary that Marsh managed to hit was a crispy shot. Okay, like the sound that came off the bat, I was actually worried for a second over there. But the fact that the wicket fell actually calmed me down a little. But yeah, getting Mitch Marsh's wicket was also Excellent. But at this point, we were already, what, 6 overs into the game. And I was starting to get worried about how Rohit Sharma is going to use Siraj after this point. And as we saw, not that well.
Yeah, and again, I think another dismissal that really became the talk of the town was Steve Smith's LBW, right? The fans treated this as a massive one, and finally a Richard Kettlebrand decision that actually came through for Team India. But how do you look at that dismissal, and do you think it was again, advantage India, because Steve Smith has had a very quiet World Cup, come on. So I think his wicket was not as big as everyone was making it out to be.
Steve Smith has had a fairly decent World Cup. Like, he had a few good knocks here and there, but Steve Smith's track record in ICC World Cup knockouts has been unbelievably top class. Because 2015 and 2019, I think he did not have anything less than 50 in the World Cup knockouts. I think he had 50 plus scores in both the semis and the finals in 2015 and the semis in 2019. And if you take a look at his knock against South Africa in the semifinals that they played this year, it was, in the context of the game, an invaluable innings because of how the pitch was playing, because of how Maharaj and Shamsi were bowling. I think that 30 that he scored in the semifinals was very, very, very precious to the team. So coming into this finals, personally, I felt that Steve Smith was going to be one of the biggest threats for us, especially after watching the wicket play out in the first innings, because of how difficult it looked like to bat on it. So I thought Steve Smith here would be quite a formidable force because he knows how to stay there. He is a test specialist after all. So I was worried, but I guess we just got a little lucky with that wicket in the end because the impact was outside, as we all saw. So, yeah, one decision
Yeah.
that just went in our favor, I guess.
Exactly. And again, these were only the dismissals to talk about, because we saw how Travis Head really, took the match away from India. It was a brilliant knock. And what is it with him and these clutch knocks versus India always coming in ICC events finals?
Look, it's not just against India. This year, I think Travis Head has played a career-defining innings at least 3 or 4 times already within the span of this 1 year, because he had a couple of brilliant knocks in the Ashes. He got himself a nice 150 against us in the World Test Championship finals. And then he shows up in the semi-finals, takes 2 wickets against South Africa, and also ends up scoring a 50 to win the game for them. And then he shows up at the finals. He bowled pretty well as well. Like, I know it'll go slightly under the radar, but Travis Head's bowling against us in the final was also pretty good. But I think the highlight of the day was his batting. Like, I mean, he's got that clutch gene, which every Australian player is just known to have at this point. So yeah, I mean, Travis Head was just pure class yesterday, and gotta hand it to him. Top class.
Certainly. And I think, playing excellent second fiddle was Manas Labuschagne, right? He was not even supposed to be a part of this squad. But look, where destiny landed him. Now, again, contextualize his performance with respect to this run chase, because we could see how the pressure was mounting, but he just seemed, so cool and really supported Travis Head from the other end, right?
Yeah, look, as I mentioned earlier, a strike rate is not something that you should be criticizing in situations like these where there's a bigger goal ahead of you, right? And I think Labuschagne played his role to absolute perfection. And it actually kind of reminded me of the innings that Pat Cummins played when Maxwell was on the other side going Mad Max, as he's known to do. But yeah, it was, in the context of the game, absolutely brilliant. And one thing I'd really like to point out over here is when the squads were announced, Australia took with them a team of 14. They left one spot open, putting all their faith in the fact that Travis Head will be all right in time for the back end of the World Cup. And they knew right then and there that they didn't want to invest in any other player. Like, they took a squad of 14. I think the fact that Marnus Labuschagne ended up being a part of the squad was actually because Ashton Agar got injured later on. So, because of Ashton Agar's injury, they managed to fit in Labuschagne in the squad. So, it actually worked out for them. But given the chance, you have Warner and Marsh as a pretty good opening combination. You also have players like Stoinis to hold your middle order together and like explode if required. So maybe Australian selectors would have been tempted to maybe pick an extra spinner in the squad instead of leaving that one spot open for Travis Head. But they showed faith in Travis Head instead, and hey, that paid off. That paid off real well for them in the semis and in the finals. And the fact that they managed to fit in Marnus Labuschagne because of Ashton Agar's injury just was an extra boost, because that also ended up helping out in the finals for them.
Certainly. And another point, that I wanted a little more elaboration from your side was how, we see this discourse around strike rate, right? So many people feel that, hey, it's such an important part of the game. Like, ODIs do require this coming in. I mean, in T20s and like even shorter formats, of course, you need the strike rate and that component is so important. But now even in ODIs and tests, we see this whole thing coming up. And even Poonam Raut, I'd say former India cricketer, had also tweeted that about this whole Marnus Labuschagne having a low strike rate and how he may not be selected for like future tours, blah blah. So do you think the whole strike rate debate is overrated, and does it like make sense? Does it still have relevance? And what are your two cents on that?
I think, as at least from a selector's point of view, or from a team management's point of view, the debate over a strike rate will completely depend on the context of the game. Like, suppose, look, in a chase, I think the strike rate debate is absolutely overrated. There is no doubt there, because in a chase, you know exactly how it's going to go. And even if you're playing with a low strike rate, as long as you get the job done, it is fine. But I think when you're batting first, there can be quite a few debates over strike rate, because of the fact that you never know how much of a total is a safe total. So you do require an anchor. An anchor role is absolutely essential, because you cannot have all batters going hammer and tongs throughout the innings. And that is something that Ashish Nehra has mentioned, which I think I brought up in the previous podcast episode that I was in as well. You cannot have every batter going all guns blazing. You need to have one or two batters who can tone things down if required and take the game deep. So yes, the strike rate debate is overrated, and in this case, specifically because it was a chase, I don't think Marnus Labuschagne did anything wrong. Especially given that he had a batter on the other end doing his job, maintaining the run rate. Like, one thing I found very, very interesting between them was the fact that they were getting a boundary on the first or second ball of every over, and then playing out the rest of the over without any risks. So you've already gotten your 4 runs, which is your required run rate. And you take a couple of singles there, you've gotten your 6 runs out of the over there itself. So they kept doing that. And in case you couldn't get boundaries off of certain bowlers like Jadeja, somehow they just managed to knock him around for 5 singles in an over, and that was just more than enough at that point. So more than the strike rate in this case, I would like to point out, in the context of the game, how much the contribution is. Like, is your low strike rate actually helping the team's calls? In this case, yes, for the Aussies, probably not for the Indians.
Fair enough. Yeah, that kind of does make sense. And even looking at how, we've spoken so much about the Aussie batting, so let's also, take our focus to the Indian bowling. So somewhere do you feel that the pressure of, defending a total this low, somewhere getting to them, and the pitch and conditions also getting quite unfavorable as the match progressed?
Okay, so I think with India's bowling by itself, they didn't do too many things wrong. The total by itself was extremely low, and let's be honest, they were 40 under the average score itself, so it wasn't really going to be anything close to defendable. But they did a good job in the power play. They did manage to get early wickets, and the dew coming in later, as I said multiple times in this episode, it is just it's not there's not much you can do in that situation. But I think the one place where we weren't up to the mark, I'd say, was with our fielding, because somewhere it looked like there was no intent shown by the fielders. Like they weren't committing themselves by putting their body on the line. Very few did that yesterday. I think Virat Kohli did it. Iyer did it a couple of times, and I think Jadeja, as usual, was pretty good in the field. Maybe aside from that one run out attempt that Jadeja had when Travis Head was on 99, because he missed by a huge distance. Like you wouldn't expect Jadeja to miss. I mean, missing is fine, but the throw that the distance between his throw and the stumps was just something else. So, I mean, the fielding perspective, I don't know, it wasn't all that great yesterday. And another large issue that I saw yesterday was with KL Rahul's keeping. I think he's been absolutely brilliant throughout the entire World Cup. And I was actually speaking to a friend of mine, and I said, the medal thing that the Indian team has been doing with the fielding performances. I said, if there is a medal for fielder of the tournament, I think KL Rahul deserved it more than anyone else. But I think his name just slipped down from that hat when he put up his performance in the finals, because I really think KL Rahul's keeping on the night of the finals was slightly subpar. He let go of a lot of leg byes and byes behind the keeper. He could have taken a few which went down the leg side, but those ended up going for five wides. And yeah, it was just even the balls just that came straight to his hand, like regular dart balls, he was fumbling them quite a bit. So I don't know, I think it's just the nerves. And you know that you put on a batting performance with a slightly you've wasted quite a few balls, your strike rate's not been the best. So his situation there, he might have been a little extra nervous with the glove in hand. But still, I think player of the tournament for me, fielding wise, has to be KL Rahul, because what he's done throughout the tournament has been absolutely top class.
Absolutely. And heading into this match, there was another big talking point of how, the umpires for the match, one of them being Richard Kettlebrough, who has this history of some very interesting decisions against Team India is going to be umpiring. And we've seen how some of his calls are very tough when it comes to Team India. So do you read into this aspect a lot that umpires can be biased or, they have the certain prejudice when it comes to a certain team and yeah, how do you play into that?
Look, specifically with Richard Kettleborough, I think he's an absolutely brilliant umpire. I think the feeling of fear that came into people's hearts when the umpires were announced had less to do with Richard Kettleborough's decision making and more to do with Richard Kettleborough's presence in the game overall. Because every knockout that we've lost since 2014, this man has been standing there as the umpire, right? And people do get superstitious. I also get superstitious when the game is on the line. But from an umpiring point of view, I think he's only made good calls in all of these knockouts that he's been in. There haven't been large controversial calls like the ones that we've seen Nitin Menon make in the past. So I would actually be much more fearful for my life if Nitin Menon was announced as the umpire, let's be honest. But Richard Kettleborough as an umpire is absolutely top class. I think he's just been there for all these ICC knockouts because he's such a good umpire. And it's just coincidentally we didn't manage to get over the line in any of those.
Yeah, I hope people don't cancel us after this episode and this specific point, because people just hate this guy. The kind of memes, jokes, you see all around social media. Wow, unbelievable.
So let's be honest, he's starting from scratch this World Cup because I think he redeemed himself for at least two or three knockout losses when he didn't give that Virat Kohli white during the Bangladesh match.
Exactly. And reflecting on this other major talking point we had, how many fans and people across social media are feeling that this Ahmedabad crowd is not being very supportive. This is especially through the phases of the game where India is not having a great time. And some fans even went on to comment on how they don't have a very rich cricketing history. So the match should have happened somewhere in, say, Mumbai, Bengaluru, or even like Kolkata for that matter. And that stadium capacity is not everything. So again, do you think it's just fans making excuses for things not going India's way and just finding something to latch onto and scapegoat it?
Look, that in a way, yes, but personally, I also have a feeling that it should be quality over quantity, right? Yes, you want to have as many fans as possible at the stadium present for the final match, and you want to have the finals in a stadium that can hold the most capacity. Although a number that popped up on Twitter earlier today to me was the total stadium capacity was 92,000 when the actual number is supposed to be 130,000 plus. And funnily enough, the 2015 World Cup final in the MCG had 93,000 people. So it actually ended up having more people than the number of people that showed up for this final. So that brings into question, does Gujarat really have the kind of audience that it takes with the cricketing knowledge that some of the other cities have, like as you mentioned, Mumbai, Bangalore, Chennai, Kolkata. I mean, specifically Bangalore and Chennai, in my opinion. I think these two cities are hands down the most knowledgeable cities throughout India with in terms of cricketing knowledge. But you want to have as many people as possible. And I don't think the lack of the number of people had anything to do with the Ahmedabad people in general. But I think it was more to do with the planning between BCCI and Book My Show. Because I will be honest with you, the booking of tickets this year was an absolute shit show. Okay. I could not, so I was sitting in that queue for hours and hours together, waiting for a ticket that's worth 3,000. And then when my turn finally shows up on the queue, there are tickets worth 20,000 and nothing else. So I have no other choice but to bail on those tickets because I'm broke. So there have been situations like that for a lot of people, and I think it was a very similar situation this year in the Narendra Modi Stadium as well. I think the missing number, why it's 92,000 and not 130,000, is probably because of the overpriced tickets. So those few tickets that you see over there which haven't been bought is just because people couldn't afford it. And aside from that, there was also a statement that was made early in the tournament by BCCI. They said 50,000 seats will be reserved for women, and I didn't really see that happening
Exactly.
anywhere.
Yeah.
Like I haven't seen any woman posting anything on any social media platform saying, "Hey, look, I got my free ticket for the World Cup game." So that's got to give us some answers from the BCCI. Yeah.
Yeah, that is quite sus. And again, one other aspect with regard to the match is how a lot of journalists said, maybe the playing 11 chosen by Team India is not ideal. And they felt, bringing in someone like an Ashwin, considering the kind of history he shares versus Australia, would be ideal in place of Sky. So, do you like again play into these things like in retrospect, like you know, having brought in this player would have done us better, and any other things that could have probably you know worked well for India if they had done it?
Look, people will say a lot of things in hindsight, but they forget to assess the actual problem here, which was our batting. And replacing Skye for Ashwin would have made that problem much worse. We probably wouldn't have had even 240 on the board. Like, Skye ended up playing pretty terribly, yes. But even though he ended up playing bad, the fact that none of the other bowlers, not even Jadeja, was able to contribute, just shows us that it was a very difficult pitch to bat on. And irrespective of whether you bring in Ashwin or not, there's no way we were defending 240.
Yeah, I think that was anyways going to be an uphill task and super challenging. But that's when due credit goes to Australia. This is their sixth World Cup title. And looking at this quite interesting stat that I came across, you know, now they've won 4 out of 6 World Cups that have been held in this century so far. And I think this is a kind of dominance that no team has even come close to matching. I mean, of course, their women's team counterpart has done it. What do you think, you know, constitutes this Aussie mindset and the fact that they keep winning? And even Cummins' captaincy, right? It has been just phenomenal. And 2023 has been his year. You've seen the win with the Ashes, the World Test Championship final, now the World Cup being theirs. Wow, I mean, it's been quite the run, right?
Look, after they got banned for the sandpaper gate, there were a lot of questions raised about where does the Australian team go from here? Because once they came back, like once they recovered from that sandpaper situation, they looked like a really nice team. Like in terms of their behavior on the field, it was not the aggressive Australians that you see all the time who are, you know, who just scary. Like if you remember the Aussies of the 2000s, nobody wants to mess with those guys. Like
Yeah.
you have Gilchrist Hayden pointing at the top, then you have McGrath, Brettley, and Shane Warne at the bottom, and throughout the middle you have people like Damian Martin, Andrew Symonds. There were names there that each of those names just struck fear into everybody's hearts. And you look at this team that came in after the 2018 ban that they went through. They walk in for the World Cup in 2019, they lose in the semis, and you think, is this really the Australian team that we've been seeing for all these years? But I think after 2021, from that T20 World Cup win, these guys have just been on fire. They've won that T20 World Cup. They came in to this Border Gavaskar trophy. They actually ended up performing pretty well. They weren't supposed to win 2-1 over here, I'll be honest with you. But the fact that they managed to win one and draw one in the Test series, that was top class. They won the World Test Championship. They won the Ashes. I mean, no, they retained the Ashes, I'm sorry. They also managed to win a World Cup after that. And there's a really, really staggering number. The Australian team, both men and women, have won a total of 26 ICC trophies.
Yes.
26. Like, take that number, put it in your head, and do what you will with it. 26 ICC trophies. You have 6 World Cups in the ODIs, and you have 1 T20 World Cup, 2 Champions Trophies, and a World Test Championship title, along with 3 under-19 titles to the men. And in addition to that, you have 7 titles in the ODI World Cup and 6 T20 World Cup titles to the women. And it is just insane because, and especially the women, you look at the T20 World Cup wins. It's been 2010, 12, 14, 18, 20, 23. It's just one after the other. And it's not just in cricket. In sport in general, you have Australians dominating across so many different sports, and it is just unreal. And one thing that's just common to all these guys is that Aussie mentality that they manage to maintain. But on the contrary, in our situation, it has just been the absolute opposite, right? We had to wait 28 years for our second World Cup. And now we've waited another 12 years for this one, and looks like we're going to have to wait 4 years more. So yeah, there's something about the Aussie mentality which is just being passed down from generation to generation, and nobody really knows the secret behind it, but it works.
Exactly. And although, Australia is riding this high, I think one really sad thing that we see is all the hate that the players are receiving, right? We see Travis Head, Mitch Marsh, Glenn Maxwell, and a bunch of these cricketers and their wives.
Jimmy Nesham received hate this morning.
Yes, exactly.
Like,
We see all of
I
this.
really don't know how, but there's people like Jimmy Nesham receiving hate because Australia beat India, and this man is putting them on his stories and enjoying it,
Yeah, so that has been really upsetting to see. So, what are your thoughts on that? And like, Indian fans really end up taking things so personally, and they just end up like attacking their partners and quite toxic, right? I even read this news that a fan, died by suicide because he's so upset with India's loss. So, is this
Yeah, from
obsession
Sampdoshna
turning?
Bengal.
So yeah, do you see this obsession turning into like weird fanaticism and kind of getting unhealthy and toxic somewhere?
I think that is something that is very common amongst a lot of Indian fans throughout the country. I really don't understand the reason for it, but as far as sports is concerned, at least amongst the sports that have largely populated numbers of fans, right? I'm not talking about things like Olympic sports. Some of them, you don't have a large population watching those sports, but maybe things like football, cricket, hockey, kabaddi, etc. This set of sports where you have a really large number of fans, I think the only two sports in India which have minimal toxicity is hockey and kabaddi. Every other sport with a really large number of fans, specifically cricket, gets extremely toxic, especially towards other players and to our own players as well. So, yeah, I mean, there's been hate everywhere, and it's not just limited to the players, that the players' wives, players' families, players' extended families, everyone's just getting abused left and right. And poor Rachin Ravindra, man, the poor guy's been born and brought up in New Zealand, and people are going and abusing him for betraying India and playing well against us. Why? He's born and brought up in New Zealand. He's a New Zealand citizen. Let him play. And Maxwell's wife, Vinnie Raman, she is also of Indian origin, but again, she is also born and brought up in Australia. Her husband is an Australian cricketer. Why would she be expected to support India? I mean, it is baffling. It does get a little sad to look at, and yeah, I don't really like it.
Exactly. And even looking at Team India now, where do we go on from here? I hope we don't see any of these reactionary retirements, axing. And what are your takeaways now? Even as we talk, the squad for the Australia tour that starts in less than 3 days has been announced. It's a
Yeah,
B team. It's a B team
No,
that's
I mean,
playing.
before we talk about that, I think my primary takeaway from this World Cup would be the number of predictions that ended up going right for me. Because, look, a lot of these have not gone on record. There are a few screenshots that are there in a few WhatsApp groups. But just specifically from the previous podcast episode that I was in, right? Episode 216, I predicted that the Indian team would pull itself together in the Asia Cup. I predicted that Yuzi Chahal would end up getting dropped from the squad again. Both of us had called the starting playing 11 almost perfectly, aside from the fact that a mosquito destroyed the starting playing 11. Shubman Gill was out of the side, but if he was there, he would have been primary pick. We called Shardul's spot in the playing 11 as well. But the most important prediction that we made in that episode was about Suryakumar Yadav's play style. And if you remember, I had spoken about how it's a style that works specifically in T20s. And when you show up in ODIs, it's something that does not work. And I think that was one fatal flaw that I found with Rohit Sharma's captaincy this time. Because he did back Suryakumar Yadav, but he backed him only as a player who comes in after the 40th over and hits boundaries for you. And the fact that you had early wickets fall this time meant that Sky had to come in and actually build an innings, which he managed to do against England. But how did he do that? He took his time. And that is how you play an ODI innings. You have to come, you have to take your time. Maybe later you go all guns blazing. But this specific statement that we'd made in that episode actually turned out to be the one factor that bit us in the back on the day of, on the night of the finals. But moving on to the actual task at hand now would be the T20 series, as you mentioned. The Aussies, look, this entire year has just been an India-Australia extended series with a few side quests in between, let's be honest.
Yeah.
Like, we had the Border Gavaskar Trophy, we had an ODI series, we had the World Test Championship, and then we had Australia come in for another ODI series before the World Cup. We had the World Cup here, then we have another T20 series. So it's just a bunch of side quests in between where we played a bunch of other teams. But the Australian team looks very solid. Matthew Wade as captain, which is a nice, surprising little pick for us. The T20 squad has actually come out. Suryakumar Yadav is the captain. Rituraj Gaikwad is the vice captain. It's very similar to the squad that ended up playing against Ireland. You have Ishan Kishan, SSV Jaiswal, Tilak Varma, Rinku Singh, Jitesh Sharma, Washington Sundar, Shivam Dubey, Akshar Patel, Ravi Krishna, Ashdeep Singh, Prasidh Krishna, Avesh Khan, Mukesh Kumar. So that's the squad that's that Australia are going to be up against. But I will be honest, I think we're losing this one 3-2.
Oh my
because
God,
the Australian side right now is much more experienced. Because the team that we're up against is, Matthew Wade is captain. I think the playing 11 that we might end up seeing when Australia takes on us might end up being something along the likes of Warner and Head opening, maybe Matt Short at number 3, Maxwell at 4, Stoinis at 5, maybe Tim David and Matthew Wade after that, Sean Abbott, maybe Nathan Ellis, Adam Zampa and Jason Berendorf. So the bowling in both situations is weak for both sides, except for the fact that you have Adam Zampa available for Australia. But from a batting perspective, I think Australia is better placed right now. So it might just end up being a 3-2 series.
Oh God, I think the Indian fans will certainly not be looking forward to this prediction of yours. But let's see how that series plays out. And quite interestingly, Sky being named skipper has, you know, again drawn a lot of like analysis from fans, experts. So yeah, it'll be interesting to see how he features as captain. Now again, coming back to this discussion.
It brings forward a very important question.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you have a T20 series against Australia now, and you don't have those many T20 games leading up to the IPL. And once the IPL is done, you have the 2024 T20 World Cup. So the question here is, where exactly do players like Rohit, Virat, Bumrah, KL and all stand when it comes to the T20 format? Because you know that Hardik Pandya is going to return as captain. So the real question would be, how do you manage to fit your experienced players into this team after you've given these youngsters such a huge run, right? That will be a very interesting question, and it'll be nice to see how that pans out in the future. And maybe they might show up for a couple of series before the IPL, you never know. But yeah, that's something to keep in mind as well.
Actually. Now, I think this might be jumping the gun, but somewhere do you also think India might have to, revamp this ODI template that they have? Because, we saw how it worked in most of the matches this World Cup, but somewhere it could have come biting back. So, do you think it's too early to judge, assess, criticize while, the players are still hurting and, coming up with this new ODI template or strategy or bringing up radical changes is not the way to go?
I think our ODI template is perfect. Honestly speaking, yes, we ended up losing that final game, but let's look at it this way. I think the only thing our ODI template lacks is an actual solid number six batter in the place of Suryakumar Yadav, and a little bit of a bowler who can offer a little bit extra batting at maybe number eight. So that is, those are the two slots that we'd have to figure out maybe before the Champions Trophy kicks in. But apart from that, I think the template by itself, at least from a batting perspective, looks absolutely solid. I mean, Rohit gives you a brilliant start. Virat anchors the innings. I don't know how long these two will go on with their careers. I mean, I'm sure Virat will play on till the 2027 World Cup. Not too sure about Rohit though, given his fitness. But as long as he's playing, you can be assured of those quick starts. So if you're getting a quick start, you have these guys to anchor. And then we saw how KL Rahul can play in the back end of the innings if he manages to come in during the death overs, if these guys have actually performed well. So the template by itself, in my opinion, is great. And if anyone says that it has to change, my question would be, what in heaven's name would you change it to? That would be a better option than this.
That's true. And just follow-up question to what you said in this point. Now you mentioned how, having this Pakka all-rounder say, will really help India's cause. But with Hardik Pandya getting frequently injured, it's obviously a concern. And you also wanted this all-rounder who can, a bowler who can offer this extra batting options. So from the current roster of players that you see in our domestic circuit and the IPL, anyone who you think can readily kind of occupy that slot in the Indian team as well, especially in this ODI setup?
Look, there are a lot of bowlers who can bat, but the issue with Indian cricket for generations and generations together has been the fact that we've been unable to produce a fast bowling all-rounder. And that is still something that haunts us, because the only two fast bowlers who can bat who are currently present in the Indian setup are probably Deepak Chahar and Shardul Thakur. Out of which, even Deepak Chahar is not exactly in the mix of things right now, and Shardul can be expensive every now and then. So the only option we have currently available to us is Hardik Pandya. From look, we do have batters who can bowl if you want to look at Shivam Dubey as an option, but Shivam Dubey as a bowler is honestly not exactly the best of options, in my opinion. So we're not really well placed with fast bowling all-rounders right now. And we never have. I think since the 80s, I don't think India found pace bowling all-rounders. Anyway, we found a couple of them, like Irfan Pathan's been there. But overall, it's been a very scanty situation for us.
Yeah, the way you didn't even mention Vijay Shankar, what about him, Sachin? What a talented player. He was there in the 2019 World Cup as
Oh,
well, right? As the number four.
three for sure. I
Yeah.
think Vijay Shankar bowled a total of 4 overs in 2019, right?
Exactly.
Yeah, look at that. Well, in that, if from that perspective, we have another bowler who can like bowl very, very quick, if you know what I mean. His name starts with Virat and ends with Kohli.
Exactly, yeah.
Man has a World Cup wicket also now. So yeah, clearly we have we're not short on all-rounders by any means.
Definitely, we have a lot of options. It's just about using them, right?
Make Ayur bowl, make Sky bowl, make Rohit Sharma bowl,
Shubman,
make everyone bowl.
exactly.
Teach Bumrah to score 35 runs in an over more frequently.
Yeah, I mean, on a lighter note, you know, I think we'll really have to look at some more options who can contribute with both the bat and ball. But yeah, as you said, I think at large, India's ODI template seems fine. But now, you know, I think the focus like directly goes to the T20 World Cup that awaits us next. Hopefully, not another heartbreak. But as we reach the end of our discussion as well, I mean, do you have any final thoughts, like words of wisdom or even a message for a lot of Indian fans and listeners who are currently hurting and, you know, just to keep them afloat? Do you have anything to say?
Look, let's be honest, throughout this entire World Cup, we've had some brilliant moments. We've seen the Indian team do a lot of things right, which is the reason why we won 10 in 10 games, which is the reason we made it to the finals. One bad game, even though it's the final of the World Cup, even though it hurts a lot, one bad game does not change the fact that this is an absolute champion side. And if you heard the tone of my voice after that West Indies series, my hopes were honestly much, much worse. So the way we ended up coming back, the way we built during the Asia Cup, the way we've actually performed has been absolutely brilliant. And I'm glad we made it to the final. I'm glad we had such a brilliant World Cup. I wanted to see the World Cup being lifted by India specifically because we just know this might be the last World Cup that Rohit and Kohli might play together in. Maybe Kohli is likely to play one more in 2027, but I don't know if Rohit will. So since this was the last time we might get to see both of them together in a World Cup, I really wanted them to lift it. But aside from the actual cricket, I think the memes, you know, the way we dissed Pakistan, the jokes about Jay Shah making the scripts, those theories that people were coming up with, the relations that we were making to the number seven present everywhere after Dhoni. And all these things just made the World Cup that much more worth the experience. And I've mentioned this on my social media as well, but I myself haven't come to terms with the 2015 ODI World Cup itself. So coming to terms with this one is going to take much, much longer. But yeah, I mean, I am sad my predictions ended up coming true, but for all the viewers out there who are listening right now, if you want to listen to more amazing predictions like this, you need to tune into this podcast and you know, listen to all this wisdom being thrown around over here. But yeah, I mean, thank you, Team India, for all the memories, I guess, because I know a lot of people are saying things like, I'm not going to watch cricket anymore, I'm
Oh my
not
God,
going to let this team break my heart again and things like that. But I know that the next time this team steps onto the field, I'm going to be sitting there tuning into Hotstar or JioCinema or something like that and putting all my heart into supporting this team all over again. And as much as I hate to say it, I'm willing to let this team break me till the end of time.
The last part sounded like you in some emo Instagram reel. You know, have you seen those edits or the
I
dish type
am
things?
most definitely in that emo phase. It's just that I didn't I managed to come to terms with this only because I made the prediction before the World Cup, so I can flex on
True.
something at least. But it hurts, man. I think this World Cup hurts more than anything else because
Definitely.
the cricketing knowledge and the amount of investment I've put into watching and being and experiencing and living this World Cup has been more than I've put into anything else than any other World Cup in the past as well. So, yeah, I mean, it does hurt,
A lot,
but
yeah.
we all know that we're going to wake up on the next time India steps onto the field and support them with just the same amount of dedication.
Certainly. I mean, you couldn't have put that more beautifully because as fans, we are hurt all the time. And sport is like that, you just can't always expect results to go your way. But here's hoping, I think hope is the one thing that really fuels us, right? We see these matches
The
hoping that.
dangerous thing, hope drives a man insane.
Yeah, and I think by the end of this thing with RCB as well, we are really, setting ourselves up for a lot of disappointment. But
Oh
yeah.
yeah, lots of training also we've had in the past 16 years with this team, prepping us for every heartbreak that the Indian team has given us.
Exactly. And now even with the auctions coming, I'm pretty sure we're going to have a lot more reasons to cry. But yeah, Sachit, that pretty much does conclude our discussion as well. Thank you so much for joining me on the podcast. I was kind of dreading this conversation, like, the match just happened yesterday. But I really felt this conversation gave a lot of closure, if that makes sense. And it really put a lot of things in perspective as well. You spoke like an expert.
I'm happy to sit and get it out, madam. I wanted to get it all off my chest, and I've been happy that
Yeah.
I was able to do that here.
And yeah, and I'm pretty sure that a lot of fans listening to us will also get that same kind of closure and listening to us just go on and on. Like, I bombarded you with some 10,000 questions. You answered them with like the
I'm
finesse of an
glad
expert.
to
Yeah,
answer them.
so here's hoping, we can again have you back. And yeah, Sachit, until next time, stay safe and take care. Here's hoping we don't have more disappointments, but it's coming our way. So yeah, that's all for now.
Thanks a lot, man. I'm always happy to be here, always happy to be back. Thank you so much.
Cheers. Thank you so much, listeners, for tuning into this episode and for your unstinted support. Please follow and press the bell icon on Spotify and subscribe to the podcast on Google Podcasts for the latest episode updates and stay tuned. Do check out @NeverOnTheBackFoot on Instagram and Threads and @NeverOnTheBackOne on Twitter, now called X, for the latest facts, updates, fresh content and a lot more that's coming up this cricket season. The podcast is also available on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, Overcast, Spotify for Podcasters, and many other platforms. So please do spread the word. Never on the Backfoot is also now on YouTube, so make sure to press the subscribe button and follow our content there as well. Until next time, stay safe and take care, listeners. Bye for now.